Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Randy Bregman. She's the executive director of Vera House in Syracuse, a human service agency focused on domestic abuse and sexual violence. She's also co-chair of the Syracuse Area Domestic and Sexual Violence Coalition and serves on the policy committee of the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Randy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, can you start by giving me an overview of the services that are provided and the kind of work that you do at Vera House?
Yes. Vera House is a comprehensive provider of services to those who have experienced both domestic or sexual violence. We began in 1977 as a shelter for battered women, and the Rape Crisis Center began a few years before, primarily providing services to sexual assault victims. When we merged in 2005, what we tried to do was take a broad continuum of service for people who have experienced sexual or domestic violence and make sure that we can help them from the point they reach out all the way through whatever they may need. So we provide the sheltering program. We provide advocacy and outreach service. We provide therapeutic counseling. And so sometimes people need all of those services. Sometimes they need one. And what I think is one of the most important things about how you access our services is there's one 24-hour support line, 468-3260 in the 315 area code. And through that, you can find someone to talk to any time of the day or night. You can seek shelter. You can say you want to get counseling for yourself or your children who've experienced a sexual assault. And we think it's important that we're available to respond to whatever the need may be and offer that broad continuum.
And what have been the recent trends in domestic abuse and sexual violence, both here in the Syracuse region and more nationally? Where have those numbers been going?
Well, and I think for all the years that I've been at Vera House, people always ask, are the numbers up or down? Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult question to answer because we think that sometimes when people are reporting more, that means that our work to do prevention and to bring awareness is effective. And people are now saying, this is my situation. So that we've seen pretty similar numbers over the 23 years I've been at Vera House in terms of the 15,000 police calls around the county to domestic violence, often three or four women a year who are killed by a current or former partner. Those numbers have been pretty steady over time. But I do think that some of that reporting is an indication that we're changing the bar in our community. I often meet people who say, before there was a Vera House, I had this situation. They're a little bit older now, and maybe it was 1972. They had absolutely nowhere to go. They never told anybody. So as we create services, we find there's more people who speak their truth, reach out for help, and we're able to serve them. I think in recent years, the trends that we've seen both nationally and in our own community is when we were founded, people thought this is a response to women who have been victimized by male partners. And what we've seen in a lot of the debate over the Violence Against Women Act over those last several years was around recognizing that there are victims who are in same-sex partnerships. There are victims who represent every cross-section of our community. And we've done a lot of work, particularly in the last decade, to make our services as accessible as possible to any person of any age, any race, any religious tradition, so that we're able to serve any survivor with comparable services. So we've worked a lot at our accessibility, whether it be because of a physical disability or a person who's deaf. We have interpretation services for somebody who speaks a language other than English. And I think the more we've made those services accessible, available, and had those conversations, the more we've seen some of those individuals coming to us for service. And I think that's been a national trend.
I want to come back to some of those differences a little bit later, but let me ask you about this kind of difference now. Are there any big regional differences in the incidence of these problems that are well known across the country?
It's interesting. There probably are some regional differences. I'm not aware of a particular trend that has maintained itself over time. What I have come to see in traveling sometimes to national conferences or state conferences and having conversations with sister agencies, I think one of the things that we're very fortunate about here in Onondaga County particularly is the resource that's available. So sometimes we'll talk about the response and what we're able to refer people to here in Onondaga County. and we'll find that other communities don't necessarily have the same resources available. So whether the incidence is different or not, what people are able to get access to, I think, varies community by community.
And you mentioned before about this phenomenon of more reporting may be an indicator that there's more awareness, and so it's progress in a way. Is there an estimate right now or an approximation for, at this moment in time, the percentage of instances of violence that are still going unreported?
I think that that number is higher when we're talking about sexual assaults now than it is domestic violence.
Okay.
So there is certainly domestic violence that's not reported, but I think that's the area we've probably seen more growth in reporting. Even some of the recent studies looking at sexual assaults in the military, sexual assaults on college campuses, all these studies coming out in the last couple of years, you're often looking at between 10 and 20% of people who report an incident of a sexual assault. So I think we're still looking to increase the numbers and the comfort and safety in people coming forward to tell their stories of sexual assault.
And what's been driving the increase in cultural awareness of this and the concern for it? Because it's part of what you've been describing so far is that that has been on the increase. Have there been particular policies or initiatives that have been driving this? Is it the presence of places like Vera House? What goes into that trend?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. The Violence Against Women Act, which was renewed again recently just a couple of years ago. I think on the state level, the Comprehensive Domestic Violence Family Protection Act that was passed in 1994. So I think, like most social change movements, there's legislation, there's community activism, there's more writing, there's more attention, there's radio shows, there's television shows, there's public service announcements. And I think that over time, we've seen the building on a foundation, and each level that comes in and brings more awareness helps to create that safety and comfort for people to come forward. I think most recently, the president issued a report on sexual assaults on college campuses, and that was spread through a lot of our email lists and other communication modes. And the tone of the conversation that he began, I think, is very different than some of what you would have read 10 or 20 years ago, even when somebody was talking about these issues. I think male leadership, male engagement, male commitment to these issues has grown tremendously, particularly in the last decade, and not in the sense of just, well, I want to protect the women around me, but in the sense of the responsibility that men have to help other men see the negative impact on their own lives as well as the lives of those they're hurting. And for me, that's been one of the most exciting parts of the work in the last decade, because social change movements usually can't happen in the hands of those who are oppressed and victimized. They need some allies who have the power and help to give voice. And that has been thrilling to me nationally and locally to watch that shift happen, to work alongside men who, if I'm sitting behind them, I'm just nodding my head at everything they're saying. And I think that's real progress for our community when it comes to the social change aspect of this. We hope ultimately one day not to need the services of Vera House and to have our primary prevention have accomplished what we seek, a world where everybody's safe in their home, safe on the street, and you don't have to worry about someone who's supposed to love and care about you being the greatest perpetrator you've ever met.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Vera House Executive Director Randy Bregman. So what would you say are the most important myths or untruths that are still out there that have currency among the public when it comes to this topic?
I don't know if this fits exactly as an untruth, but one of the things that I think we hear most often, what's the first question on everybody's mind when it comes to an incident of domestic violence, if we start with that issue? People say, why does she stay? Why didn't she just leave? And there are a variety of myths that kind of get unpacked from that particular phrasing. One is, I find it fascinating that we as a community don't ask the question, why does someone hit and hurt and humiliate and put fear in someone they're supposed to love and care about? Instead, we ask the question about the victim, which really is illogical to me. But I know people still have that question. And so when they have that, I think it's important to understand the reality of the barriers to leaving that most people face. First of all, most people in an abusive relationship want the abuse to end, but they may want the relationship to continue. I think that's a myth that people have, is if they've been hurt in a relationship, if it's been abusive, it must be totally negative and they should be running as far as they can, whereas life and relationships are usually more complicated than that. So it may take a while for somebody to recognize that they can't maintain the good parts of the relationship without the abuse, because that depends on the person who's hurting them making different choices. So I think there's a lot in that perception of why does somebody stay, and not understanding the barriers to leaving. And one is that connection, that sense of wanting the relationship to work in the good parts. The other is fear. So often in our community and across the nation, when I talked about domestic violence homicide rates, that the person who's killed has left the relationship, either emotionally or physically. That's a reality. The most dangerous time for a person is within the six months after they leave that relationship. When I look at the homicides in the years I've been at Vera House, more of them than not were people who were in the process of trying to leave the relationship. So there's a real-life fear that we can't guarantee people safety, and sometimes they think they're better able to keep themselves and others they love safe by staying in the relationship. So I think those challenges are real, and that's part of the myth. On the sexual assault side, I think the greatest myth is still the sense that a rapist is the stranger in the bushes lurking at night when you're coming down the path, when the vast majority of sexual assaults happen by people the victim knows, and they're often in a more complicated relationship than people expect. And so there's a lot of denial and minimization of the reality of that rape experience because the victim and the perpetrator don't fit the stereotypes in people's minds.
And I wanted to ask you the question that you already put, which was the correct question: why do people do this? I know that that is incredibly complicated, but still, to the best of our knowledge, what do we know at this point about why people engage in abusive and sexually violent behavior?
For us, in the lens that we use in our work, there's a foundation of a desire to have power and control over another person. There are a host of factors that come in, and we don't want to be naive and say it's only item A, and if you talk about that, you've addressed all potential for domestic or sexual violence. Sometimes people have physical or chemical abnormalities. Sometimes they have traumatic brain injury. There may be a psychiatric impairment. All of those can be part of the picture. But in a lot of the cases that we've worked with, people may not fit any of those diagnoses. And ultimately, what they're trying to do is maintain control over something in their lives. Often they may not feel they have the control they want in their own life. And so there's a desire to find power and control by using it against another person. And we have an alternatives program we've had for 24 years now in the community. That program has worked with men who've been abusive to their female partners. And I remember the first coordinator of the program many years ago talking about how many men would come to the program and basically be looking to find a non-abusive way to control their partner, instead of recognizing that you have to release the belief that you have a right to control another person. And I believe that's a core element, but I don't want to ignore some of the other complex factors that come into the mix.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Vera House Executive Director Randy Bregman. Well, what are the best policy ideas that are out there right now to address and ameliorate these problems of domestic and sexual violence?
That's a complicated question for me, because when I came into the work in 1990, there was a big move toward criminalization of domestic violence, and I supported and continue to support a lot of those policies. Essentially, we said as a community that domestic violence should not be considered a family matter, that it should be considered a crime, and that people should be held accountable. And a lot of policies have changed to do that. We have mandatory reporting policies. We have mandatory arrest policies. We have pro-prosecution policies where they won't accept a victim's request to drop charges because it's the people of the state versus the defendant. And I think all those policies are good. But I think we heard a lot in the last decade from survivors and people representing marginalized communities. The criminal justice system can't be the only answer. And so I think policies in recent years that are looking more at supporting primary prevention work, engaging people in the conversation earlier, that's a really important part of what we are hoping to do. And that's where, with some of the president's report looking at the campus sexual assaults, again, there's a dual emphasis. One is policies that ensure that there's a response to victims where they're supported and given safe options. That is critically important. And part of the response policy has to be that offenders are held accountable for their behavior. That's part of how you create the change we seek. But you also need primary prevention opportunities and directives where people are getting education information earlier. It's not uncommon at all when we're doing a program in one of the schools that we present to, that when you ask students to brainstorm what's an abusive relationship look like, they can list 50 things. And when you say, what's a healthy relationship look like, they might answer love. They don't really know the elements of a healthy relationship. So I think policies that help us do primary prevention work, give messages about gender roles, about power, about alternatives to violence, that we need to be building that into our policy agenda as well. The other thing I find often is we pass policy, particularly state legislation, and then the implementation gets shoved to the side. So we have good laws, but we need to be responsible, and I think it's an important part of the role of victim advocates like ourselves to make sure that the policies are being followed, because sometimes people want to pass a law, pass a law, pass a law, and a law is only as meaningful as its implementation. So I think that's been an important part of our work, particularly in New York State, to ensure that when there's an unexpected consequence of a law, that we're back there looking at how do we implement and make sure we're achieving the goal we seek.
You mentioned mandatory reporting and mandatory arrest. I wanted to ask you about that. One of the things that I've read about those is that there's a double-edged quality to those, and it sort of gets back to something you said before about the person wanting the abuse to end but not the relationship. I've read that on the one hand, you know, they encourage more action. On the other hand, they could have a chilling effect on some victims' willingness to come forward because they understand what's going to happen if they, in a sense, make that move. So is your sense that there is indeed a trade-off there? And how do we think about that?
I think that's a very fair point, and I believe there is a trade-off, and there are some victims who don't want to call for help because they don't want to see the perpetrator arrested. I think with any policy shift, you see some pros and some cons. I think as a whole, I believe that domestic violence or sexual assault are crimes that need to be responded to and that offenders need to be held accountable. What that accountability looks like is part of the question that I think we need to continue the dialogue about. Many times a victim does not want to see the perpetrator held in jail, and jail is expensive, not usually very effective in changing behavior, a host of other things to think about. So I think when you can have programs that give victims options for the consequence so that they don't have to necessarily think the only option is jail, and we've seen that kind of responsiveness in our community from the district attorney's office and from others who are involved, if what they really want is to have the abusive person sent to the alternatives program to get that education, maybe be put on probation so there's some accountability. A lot of perpetrators don't end up going to jail. And I think that's really the fear that most victims have, is the perpetrator going to jail. The idea that the perpetrator will get education and be encouraged by somebody other than themselves to change their behavior, that's often a positive. So I think sometimes it's nuanced in how we talk about what mandatory arrest means. I often say to people, you know, if you watch television shows, you think the police come and that's the end of the show in a lot of shows. But in the real world, in Syracuse, they arraign 7 days a week. So if they pick somebody up at 10 o'clock at night, they're usually going to be out the next day. They're either released on their own recognizance, they get bail. So the reality is not sometimes what people have stereotypically thought. And I don't think we want to give up on the idea that people have to be accountable for their behavior. So that's the trade-off we have.
I imagine that as LGBT couples have become more empowered and accepted in recent decades, that more of these individuals then might be coming forward as victims. Are there treatments and interventions that are different in that realm than they are in the other more traditional realms?
I think in some communities, New York City, for example, has targeted services for lesbian and gay victims. I think in our community, we're a little bit smaller, and so that we do provide services to lesbian women and gay men and transgender individuals who've experienced violence. But right now, they're integrated into other programming. And it's interesting, we've sheltered men over the last 5 years, men who are victimized by other men and men who have been victimized by a female partner. It's a small percentage, probably 5% of what we're sheltering. People had a lot of concern what's going to happen when you bring a male victim in with women who've been victimized by men. But what we've found is that the experience of victimization is the common thread. And so that people very quickly seem to get past issues like gender and gender identity and sexual orientation and race and really connect around empowering one another to move forward in healthy ways. So we've seen integrated programs have typically worked for us, and all of our programs and services are open to people regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, whatever their difference may be.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Vera House Executive Director Randy Bregman. I would think that this has got to be some of the most harrowing work on the planet. So what keeps you and the staff at Vera House going?
I think there's a few core things that keep staff going. One is you get up every day and you know that the work you're doing means something and is important and makes a difference. And I think that gives people a lot of energy to get up and do it the next day. I think the other thing I've thought a lot about the last few years is the sense of a second family and a community you create when you do this kind of work. So that whether it's volunteers, staff, some of our board who are most closely connected, you really create a community of support so that if someone at Vera House is dealing with a really difficult case, really triggers their own feelings of trauma, they have a support system the moment they step outside wherever they had that conversation. There's somebody they can pull in, somebody they can go to who can sit and understand that. So I think the support system that we have created and the meaning of the work is what keeps people going. We just had a staff meeting this morning and we celebrate anniversaries, and somebody who's been at the agency 26 years and 22 years, and you find your strength through other people I respect, come to the agency, work a few years, really make a difference, carry what they learned forward into wherever they go next. But they say, I can't do this every day for the rest of my life. And one of the most important things in this work is that you know yourself, you take care of yourself, and you do what's right for you.
And listening to you describe that, it sounds almost like part of the work is really, it reminds me of what you would find in a religious community in a way. And so I was curious about that. Are the people that tend to draw into this kind of work, do they tend to be more religious, less religious? Are there any patterns that you'd see there?
That's interesting. I probably don't know everybody's religious beliefs, but the people that I do know, we have a pretty wide cross-section from people who would say they do not believe at all, and people for whom their religious tradition is what grounds them and keeps them going day to day. So it's a pretty wide range.
And more personal question, if I could, what motivated you to go into this line of public service?
It's interesting because I'm not one of the people who said I always wanted to work in the field of domestic or sexual violence. I actually came from a policy background. I was a political science major at SUNY Albany. I did 2 semesters of internship back in the days when the requirements were a little less structured. I did a NYPIRG lobbying internship and then an internship with New York State Assembly Member Pete Granitz. I loved that work, and I was always going to be out in the public world. My yearbook says, you'll be my senator, I'll vote for you. So that was kind of my direction. And then I ended up back in Syracuse, where it was a little bit harder to figure out what the policy was going to be, but I wanted to raise a family and be close to family, and ended up finding a calling to go to social work school back in the days when you had to go to a library and pick up a catalog and read things, I'm trying to explain to my kids.
Nobody knows
how
you, right?
And I read and realized that sometimes on the policy front, it was hard to tell if I was making a difference. And when I thought about social work, I thought maybe one-on-one I can feel a little bit more like I'm making a difference. So I was going to be a therapist. I did my second year field placement at St. Joe's. And I read an ad the spring of my graduating year that talked about a position as coordinator of the Domestic Violence Coalition. And I said, wow, I think I'd want to do that, even though I thought I was going to do this one person in a room. And then when I got to Vera House and had that position, I found that I also wanted to do the sit with a person in the room. And what I was able to find at Vera House was the ability to take the individual in the room and connect that to the larger policy changes we needed, and then to take the policy changes and make sure that the individual in the room benefited from them, that implementation piece. And 6 months after I started at Vera House, this is the piece, almost sounds religious, I realized I found a calling. Mm. And I've been there for 23 years and imagine I'll retire from there a number of years later because the work has given my life that kind of meaning.
And I know that Vera House is starting its White Ribbon campaign soon. Part of its purpose, of course, is to raise money for the center. But tell me briefly what the other goals of the campaign are.
Well, the White Ribbon campaign is really a male leadership campaign. It was first founded in Montreal, Canada, after a man took a number of female students on a campus into a room and took their lives. And there was a group of men in Canada that said, we want to be part of the solution. We want to ensure that men recognize the impact of their violence on women and do something about it. And so 20 years ago now, Vera House brought that campaign to our community. And we've had wonderful male leaders over the years. This year, Sean Kirst is our honorary chair. And the men invite women, of course, to be involved in the campaign. But it is an opportunity for men to speak up and say they want to be part of changing the culture that has allowed violence against women, domestic violence, sexual assault. And we're very excited to be in our 20th year. And yes, it's a fundraising event, but more importantly, it really is that primary prevention message that when you pin on your ribbon, you're saying you won't commit, support, or remain silent about abuse. And when somebody asks you why you're wearing that ribbon, you have to be able to have that conversation. That's what it means to me. So we're looking forward to a wonderful campaign and hoping that we're able to bring the message out about the culture change that we need to accomplish.
And if someone is interested in helping out with that campaign, then should they go to your website? What should they do?
The website's the easiest, probably. If you go to verahouse.org, everything should be on there. Or you can call our offices at 425-0818, and we'd love to have you. You can have a five-person campaign in your office. You can join us on the walk on March 28th. You can find whatever your comfort zone is. But join us, and we hope tens of thousands of others in making a concerted effort to end this violence in our community.
And you mentioned this at the outset, but I want to give you a chance to repeat it at the end, too. If someone's listening to this and they feel like they may be or have been a victim of abuse or violence, how can they get in touch with your organization? What should they do?
Our 24-hour support line number is 315-468-3260, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can reach a trained counselor who can take your call.
Okay, great. And let me get to the three questions at the end now. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I think the chapter title I would choose is Counting My Blessings, and I realize that's probably more a personal than a professional answer, but I became a grandmother 10 weeks ago, and every day I just step back and look at the gifts that life has given me and how thankful I am. So I think that would be it.
Second, what's your worst trait?
My worst trait is I'm probably a little obsessive and I want everything to be a certain way, and I have to work on recognizing when I've set a standard that might not be obtainable and might maybe hurt other people by creating such a high standard. So I think it's that obsessiveness.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I think there's probably two things that come to mind. One is the merger with Rape Crisis in 2005 and the journey it took to get there and the challenges along the way and the people who were naysayers and the people who came along to help us accomplish it. And I think the other is this piece about men getting engaged in the work. And there are some advocates, victim advocates in other communities that really struggle with the attention that men get for doing this work and getting involved. And they say, we've been saying the same thing for 20 years. But I know for myself, the first time I really heard a man speak was on the Syracuse University campus when Don McPherson came, brought by Jerome Hall, who used to work for us and had played with Don on the 1987 team. And when I heard Don McPherson speak, a lot of the words that I had heard 100 women speak before about changing culture, about men taking responsibility, I sobbed all the way through his presentation. And so I think for me, the impact again of people who have that power being willing to be part of the solution and being very active in encouraging that has been a real turning point for me.
That was Randy Bregman. The Vera House White Ribbon Campaign starts March 28th. Randy, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
For a longer version of the conversation you've just heard, please go to wrvo.org and please tune in again to WRVO Public Media for more conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Research assistance was provided by Brooke Weinstein. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. Visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations for more information.